the light turned steadily with its slow, low hum. Far below, he could see the single oil light from the cottage. He'd been working for an hour when some instinct made him turn, and he found Lucy watching him, her eyes glittering in the soft light. When his gaze met hers, she smiled, and yet again Tom was caught off guard by the miracle of her. So beautiful, so undefended. She raised her bandaged hand and examined it. "I've been in the wars, Dadda," she said, and a frown crept over her features. She held her arms out. "You go back to sleep, Lily," Tom said, and tried to turn back to his work. The child said, "I'll away, Dadda," and she kept her arms extended. Tom lifted her onto his lap and rocked her gently. "You'd get nightmares if I sang to you, Lulu. Mama's the singer, not me." "I hurt my hand, Dadda," she said, raising her injury as proof. "You did, didn't you, Bunny Rabbit?" He kissed the bandage delicately. "It'll soon be better, you'll see." He kissed her forehead and stroked her fine blonde hair. "Ah, oh, Lulu, Lulu. However did you find your way here?" He looked away out into the solid blackness. "However did you turn up in my life?" He could feel her muscles surrender as she edged towards sleep. Gradually her head weighed loosely against the crook of his arm. In a whisper even he could hardly hear, he asked the question that gnawed at him constantly. "How did you ever make me feel like this?" Chapter 20 I never knew he'd tried to get in touch. Tom was sitting beside Isabel on the veranda. He was turning over and over an ancient battered envelope addressed to him, care of 13th Battalion, AIF. On every available inch of space were scrawled forwarding addresses and instructions, culminating in an authoritative command in blue pencil to return to sender. To Edward Sherborne, Esquire, Tom's father. The letter had arrived in a small packet 3 days earlier when the June boat brought news of his death. The letter from Church, Hattersley and Parfitt solicitors observed the formalities and provided only the facts. Throat cancer, 18th of January 1929. It had taken them some months to track Tom down. His brother Cecil was the exclusive beneficiary, save for the bequest to Tom, of a locket of his mother's, enclosed in the letter which had pursued Tom across the world. He'd opened the packet after he'd lit up that evening, sitting in the lantern room, numb at first as he read the stern, spiky handwriting. Merivale, Sydney, 16th of October, 1915. "Dear Thomas, I'm writing because I know that you have enlisted. I'm not much of a one for words, but with you so far away now, with the possibility that harm may come to you before we have an opportunity to meet again, it seems that writing is the only way. There are many things I cannot explain to you without denigrating your mother, and I have no wish to do any more harm than has already been done. Some things, therefore, will be left unsaid. I am at fault in one respect, and it is in this I wish to remedy now. I enclose a locket which your mother asked me to let you have when she left. It has her likeness in it. At the time I felt it was better for you not to be reminded of her, and I therefore did not pass it on. It was not an easy decision to make, to determine that your life would be better without her influence. Now that she is dead, I feel it right to fulfill her request, if rather late. I've tried to raise you as a good Christian. I've tried to ensure you have had the best available education. I hope I've instilled in you a sense of right and wrong. No amount of worldly success or pleasure can redeem the loss of your immortal soul. I'm proud of the sacrifice you have made by enlisting. You have grown into a responsible young man, and after the war I would be pleased to find you a position in the business. Cecil has the makings of a fine manager, and I expect will run the factory successfully after my retirement, but I am sure a suitable place can be found for you. It pained me that I had to hear of your embarkation through others. I would have welcomed the opportunity to see you in uniform, to see you off. But I gather that since tracing your mother and learning she has passed away, you wish to have nothing further to do with me. Therefore, I leave it up to you. If you choose to reply to this letter, I shall be most pleased. You are, after all, my son, and until you two are a father, you will not fully understand all it means to say that. If, however, you do not wish to respond, I shall respect your choice and shall not trouble you again. I shall nonetheless pray for your safety in battle and your return to these shores victorious. Your affectionate father, Edward Sherborne. Seemed a lifetime since Tom had spoken to this man. How it must have cost him to write such a letter. That his father had made an attempt to contact him after their bitter separation was not just a surprise, but a shock. Nothing seemed certain anymore. Tom wondered whether his father's coldness protected a wound all along. For the first time he glimpsed something beyond the stony exterior, and just for an instant he could imagine a man of high principle, hurt by a woman he loved, but unable to show it. Tom had sought out his mother for a particular reason, as he had stood at the boarding house door, shoes polished, fingernails cut. He had rehearsed the words one last time. "I'm sorry I got you into trouble." At the time he felt as shaky as a child who'd waited 13 years to say the words. He thought he might be sick. "All I said was that I'd seen a motor car, that there'd been a motor car at the house. I didn't know." It was only years later that he'd understood the full magnitude of his tale-telling. She'd been declared an unfit mother and banished from his life. But his pilgrimage to seek forgiveness was too late. He would never now hear his mother absolve him from the guilt of betrayal, innocent though it had been. Words had a way of getting into all sorts of places they weren't meant to. Best keep things to yourself in life, he'd learnt. He looked at the picture of his mother in the locket. Perhaps each of his parents had loved him, however brokenly. He felt a sudden surge of anger at his father's almost casual assumption of the right to separate him from his mother. So sincere, yet so destructive. It was only when a droplet sent the ink running in miniature rivers that Tom noticed he was crying. "Until you two are a father, you will not fully understand." Beside him now on the veranda, Isabel was saying, "Even though you hadn't seen him for years, he was still your dad. You only ever get one of them, it's bound to affect you, sweetheart." Tom wondered if Isabel caught the irony of her own words. "Come on, Luce, come and have some coca," she called without pausing. The little girl ran up and grasped the beaker with both hands. She wiped her mouth with her forearm instead of her grubby hand, and then handed back the cup. "Ta-ta," she called out cheerily. "I'm riding to Patereurs now, go and see Grandma and Grandpa," and ran back to her hobby horse. Tom looked at the locket in the palm of his hand. For years I thought she hated me because I gave away her secret. I never knew about the locket. His lower lip pressed upwards and pursed his mouth. Would have made a difference. "I know there's nothing I can say, I just wish I could, I don't know, make it better for you." "Mama, I'm hungry," called Lucy as she came back. "No wonder with all that running about," said Isabel and swept her up in her arms. "Come on, come and give Dada a hug, he's sad today." And she set the child on his lap so that they could both hug him tightly. "Smile, Dada," said the little girl. "Like this," she said, and grinned. The light came in crooked through the clouds, seeking refuge from the rain that hovered in the distance. Lucy sat on Tom's shoulders, beaming at her towering view. "This way," she exclaimed, stabbing a finger to her left. Tom altered course and carried her down the field. One of the goats had chewed its way out of a temporary pen, and Lucy had insisted on helping find it. There was no sign of the creature in the cove. Well, it couldn't have got far. "We'll look somewhere else," said Tom. He strode up towards the flat of the land once more and turned in a circle. "Where to now, Lulu? You pick." "Down there," she pointed again to the other side of the island, and they set off. "How many words do you know that sound like goat?" "Boat." "That's right, any more?" The child tried again. "Boat?" Tom laughed. "What do you wear when it's cold?" "My jumper." "Yes. But what do you wear when it's cold that sounds like goat? Starts with a k sound." "Coat!" He tickled her tummy. "Coat, boat, goat. Talking of which, look, Luce, down there near the beach." "She's there, let's run, Dada," Let's not bunny rabbit. Don't want to scare her away. We'll take it quietly. Tom was so preoccupied that he hardly noticed at first where the animal had chosen its new pasture. Down you get, little one. He lifted Lucy high over his shoulders and lowered her to the grass. You be good and stay here while I go and get Flossie. I'm going to tie this rope to her collar and then she'll come back nice and easy. Right, Flossie, come on now. No buggering about. The goat looked up and trotted a few paces away. Enough of that, stay still. Tom caught it by the collar and fastened the rope. Yeah, that's it. All right, Lulu. Turning, he felt a tingling in his arms, a split second before his conscious mind realized why. Lucy was sitting on a slight mound where the grass grew more thickly than on the flatter land around it. Usually he avoided this part of the island, which seemed to him permanently shadowed and gloomy no matter how bright the day. Look, I found a seat, Dada, she said, beaming. Lucy, off that right now, he shouted before he could stop himself. Lucy's face puckered and tears came at the shock. She'd never been shouted at before and she started to bawl. He raced to pick her up. Sorry, Lulu, I didn't mean to scare you, he said, ashamed of his response, trying to hide his horror. He hurried a few steps away. That's not a good place to sit, love. Why not? She wailed. It's my special seat. It's magic. It's just... He snuggled her head into the crook of the neck. It's just not a good place to sit, sweetie. He kissed the top of her head. Are I naughty? Asked Lucy, confused. No, not naughty. Not you, Lulu. He kissed her cheek and brushed her fair hair out of her eyes. But as he held her, he was for the first time in years acutely aware that the hands that now touched her were the hands that had heaved her father into the grave. Eyes closed, he recalled the sensation in his muscles, the weight of the man, and contrasted it with the weight of the daughter. Lucy seemed the heavier of the two. He felt a patting on his cheeks. Dada, look at me, the child said. He opened his eyes and looked at her in silence. Finally, with a deep breath, he said, Time to take Flossie home. Why don't you hold the rope? She nodded and he wrapped it around her hand, carrying the weight of her back up the hill on his hip. That afternoon in the kitchen, Lucy was about to climb onto a chair but first turned to Tom. Is this a good place to sit, Dada? He didn't look up from the door handle he was repairing. Yes, that's a good place, Lulu, he replied without thinking. When Isabel went to sit beside her, Lucy exclaimed, No, Mama, off that chair, that's not a good place to sit. Isabel laughed. It's where I always sit, sweetie. I think it's a lovely seat. It's not a good place, Dada says. What's she talking about, Dada? I'll tell you later, he said, and took up his screwdriver, hoping Isabel would forget. But she did not. Once she'd tucked Lucy into bed, Isabel asked again, What was all that palaver about where to sit? She was still worried about it when I sat on her bed for the story, told me you'd be very cross. Oh, just a game she came up with. She'll probably have forgotten about it by tomorrow. But Lucy had summoned up the ghost of Frank Roenfelt that afternoon, and the memory of his face now haunted Tom every time he looked in the direction of the graves. Until you two are a father. He'd thought a great deal about Lucy's mother, but it was only now that the full sacrilege of his treatment of her father came home to him. Thanks to him, the man could never have a priest or a pastor mark his passing with due ritual. Never be allowed to live even in memory, in Lucy's heart, as was her father's right. For a moment, just a few feet of sand had separated Lucy from her true heritage, from Roenfelt and generations of his family. Tom went cold at the realization that he may have killed relatives, seemed almost likely, of this man who had created her. Suddenly vivid and accusing, the faces of the enemy wakened from the tomb beneath the memory to which he had confined them. The next morning, as Isabel and Lucy went to collect the eggs, Tom set about straightening things in the lounge room, putting Lucy's pencils in a biscuit tin, stacking up her books. Amongst them he found the prayer book Ralph had given her at her christening, and from which Isabel often read to her. He flicked through the feathery pages, edged with gold, morning prayers, communion rites. Going through the Psalms, his eyes came to rest on number 37, Noli Amulari. Fret not thyself because of the ungodly, neither be thou envious amongst the evildoers, for they shall be cut down like the grass, and be withered even as the green herb. Isabel and Lucy, the little girl in a piggyback, came in laughing at something. "Gosh, this is clean. Have the magic pixies been in?" asked Isabel. Tom shut the book and put it on top of the pile. "Just trying to put things in order," he said. A few weeks later, Ralph and Tom were sitting, backs resting against the stone wall of the storage shed, having unloaded the last of the September supplies. Bluey was down on the boat, sorting out a problem with the anchor chain, and Isabel was in the kitchen with Lucy, making gingerbread men. It had been a hard morning, and the two men sat sharing a bottle of beer in the first tentative spring sunshine. For weeks, Tom had been anticipating this moment, considering how he could approach the subject when the boat arrived. He cleared his throat before asking, "Have you ever done anything wrong, Ralph?" The old man cocked Tom a look. "What the bloody hell's that supposed to mean?" The words had come out awkwardly despite all Tom's planning. "I'm talking about, well, how you put something right when you buggered it up. How you fix it." His eyes were focused on the black swan on the beer label and he struggled to keep his nerve. "I mean something serious." Ralph took a swig of beer and looked at the grass as he nodded slowly. "Want to say what? None of my business, of course. I'm not trying to stick me beak in." Tom was very still, sensing bodily the relief that would follow the unburdening of the truth about Lucy. "My father dying got me thinking about everything I've done wrong in life and about how to put it right before I die." He opened his mouth to go on, but an image of Isabel bathing their stillborn son silenced him and he balked. "I'll never even know their names." He was surprised at how readily the space had been filled with other thoughts, other guilt. "Whose names?" Tom hesitated, poised on the edge of a chasm, deciding whether to dive. He drank some beer. "The men I killed." The words fell blunt and heavy. Ralph weighed up his response. "Well, that's what you do in a bloody war. Kill or be killed." "More time passes, the madder everything I've done seems." Tom had a sense of being physically trapped in each separate past moment, held in some vice that pressed him into every bodily sensation, every guilt-filled thought that had mounted up over the years. He struggled for breath. Ralph was completely still, waiting. Tom turned to Ralph, suddenly shaking. "Jesus Christ, I just want to do the right thing, Ralph. Tell me what the right fucking thing to do is. I just can't stand this. I can't do it anymore." He threw the bottle to the ground and it shattered on a rock as his words dissolved into a sob. Ralph put an arm around him. "There now, boy, easy does it, easy does it. I've been round a shade longer than you, seen all sorts. Right and wrong can be like bloody snakes, so tangled up you can't tell which is which until you shot 'em both and then it's too late." He looked at Tom, a long wordless look. "The question I'd ask is, how would raking over the coals make things better? You can't put any of that right now." The words, devoid of judgment or animosity, twisted like a knife in Tom's guts just the same. "Christ, the quickest way to send a bloke mad is to let him go on refighting his war till he gets it right." Ralph scraped at a callus on his finger. "If I'd had a son, I'd be proud if he turned out half as well as you. You're a good bloke, Tom. A lucky bloke with that wife and that daughter of yours. Concentrate on what's best for your family now. Fella upstairs has given you a second chance. I reckon he's not too fussed about whatever you did or didn't do back then. Stick to now. Put right the things you can put right today and let the ones from back then go. Leave the rest to the angels, the devils, or whoever's in charge of it." "Salt. You never get rid of the salt. Eats away like a cancer if you don't watch out." It was the day after his talk with Ralph, and Tom was muttering to himself. Lucy sat beside him in the giant glass cocoon of his lens, feeding her rag doll imaginary sweets as he buffed and polished the bronze fittings. Her blue eyes beamed up at him. "Are you Dolly's daughter too?" she asked. Tom stopped. "I don't know. Why don't you ask Dolly?" She leaned to whisper something to the doll, then announced, "She says no, you're just my dadda. Her face had lost its round shape and was now giving hints of her future self. Blonde hair rather than the earlier dark shade, and inquiring eyes, fair skin. He wondered whether she'd begin to resemble her mother or her father. He thought back to the face of the blonde man he had buried. Dread crawled up his spine as he imagined her asking him harder questions as the years went on. He thought, too, how his reflection in the mirror now offered glimpses of his own father's face at his age. Likeness lies in wait. Part of Jeus was small. A mother might fail to recognize her infant in the face of a toddler. But eventually, wouldn't she see herself in the grown woman? The thought gnawed away at him. He dabbed the rag into the tin of polish and rubbed again, until the sweat trickled into the corners of his eyes. That evening, Tom was leaning against the veranda post, watching the wind blow the sun into night. He had lit up and the tower was now settled down until dawn. He had gone over Ralph's advice again and again. Put right the things you can put right today. "Here you are, Dale," said Isabel. "She's gone off to sleep. I had to read Cinderella 3 times. She put an arm around Tom and leaned into him. "I love the way she pretends to read as she turns the pages. Knows the stories by heart." Tom did not reply, so Isabel kissed him below the ear and said, "You could always have an early night. I'm tired, but not too tired." He was still looking out at the water. "What does Mrs. Rowenfelt look like?" It took a moment for Isabel to register that the reference was to Hannah Potts. "What on earth do you want to know that for?" "Why do you think?" "She doesn't look a bit like her. Lucy's blonde with blue eyes. She must have got that from her father." "Well, she sure as hell didn't get it from us." He turned to face her. "Izzy, we've got to say something. We have to tell her."
"Lucy? She's too young to..."
"No, Hannah Rowenfelt." Isabel looked horrified.
"What for?"
"She deserves to know." She shivered. In dark moments she had wondered whether it was worse to believe your daughter was dead, that she was alive and you would never see her. She had imagined Hannah's torment. But even a moment's agreement with Tom would be fatal, she knew. "Tom, we've done this one to death. It just isn't right to put your niggling conscience above Lucy's welfare."
"Niggling conscience? For the love of God, Isabel, we're not talking about swiping sixpence from the collection plate. We're talking about a child's life and a woman's life, for that matter. Every moment of our happiness is on her tab. That can't be right, no matter how much we try to think our way out of it. Tom, you're tired and you're sad and you're confused. In the morning you'll think differently. I'm not going to talk about it anymore tonight."
She touched his hand and fought to mask the tremble in her voice.
We're not in a perfect world. We have to live with that."
He stared at her, seized by the sensation that perhaps she didn't exist. Perhaps none of this existed, for the inches between them that seemed to divide two entirely different realities. And they no longer joined. Lucy is particularly fond of looking at the photographs taken of her as a baby on a visit to Partishes.
"That's me," she tells Tom as she sits on his knee and points to the picture on the table. "But I was only little then. Now I'm a big girl."
"You certainly are, sweetie. 4 next birthday."
"That," she says, pointing authoritatively, "is Mama's Mama."
"Quite right.
Mama's Mama is Grandma. And that's Dada's Dada."
"No, that's Mama's Dada. That's Grandpa."
Lucy looks sceptical.
"Yeah, it's confusing, I know. But Grandma and Grandpa aren't my Mum and Dad."
"Who are your Mum and Dad?"
Tom shifted Lucy from one knee to the other.
"My Mum and Dad were called Eleonora and Edward."
"Are they my Grandma and Grandpa too?" Tom sidestepped the question.
"They both died, sweetie."
"Ah," said Lucy, and nodded seriously in a way that made him suspect she had no idea what he's talking about.
"Like Flossie."
Tom had forgotten about the goat that had become ill and died a few weeks earlier.
"Well, yes, like Flossie died." "Why did your Mama and Dada die?"
"Because they were old and sick," he added. "It was a long time ago."
"Will I die?"
"Not if I can help it, Lulu." But lately, every day with this child seemed a precarious thing. The more she had access to words, the greater her ability to excavate the world around her, carving out the story of who she was. It gnawed away at Tom that her understanding of life and herself would be founded on a single enormous lie. A lie he himself had helped to craft and refine. Every surface in the light room gleamed. Tom had always kept it diligently, but now he waged war on every screw, every fitting, until it surrendered a brilliant sheen. These days he smelt permanently of duriglit. The prism sparkled and the beam shone, unhindered by a speck of dust. Every cog in the works moved smoothly. The apparatus had never functioned with more precision. The cottage, on the other hand, had suffered. "Couldn't you just put a bit of putty in that crack?" Isabel asked as they sat in the kitchen after lunch. "I'll do it once I'm ready for the inspection." "But you've been ready for the inspection for weeks. For months, for that matter. It's not as if the king's coming, is it?" "I just wanted shipshape, that's all. I've told you, we're in with a chance for the Point Moore posting. We'd be on land, close to Geraldton, near people, and we'd be hundreds of miles from Partagers." "Time was you couldn't bear the thought of leaving, Janus." "Yeah, well, times change." "It's not that times change, Tom," she said. "You're the one who always says that if a lighthouse looks like it's in a different place, it's not the lighthouse that's moved." "Well, you work out what has," he said as he picked up his spanner and headed off down to the storage sheds without looking back. That night, Tom took a bottle of whiskey and went to watch the stars from near the cliff. The breeze played on his face as he traced the constellations and tasted the burn of the liquid. He turned his attention to the rotation of the beam and gave a bitter laugh at the thought that the dip of the light meant that the island itself was always left in darkness. "The lighthouse is for others, powerless to illuminate the space closest to it." Chapter 21. The celebration at Point Partagers 3 months later was big by Southwest standards. The superintendent of the Mercantile Marine Office had come all the way from Perth, together with the state governor. The town worthies were there, the mayor, the harbour master, the vicar, as well as three of the last five light keepers. They had gathered to commemorate the day on which Janus was first lit, 40 years earlier, in January 1890. The occasion brought with it a grant of brief, special shore leave for the Sherborne family. Tom ran his finger between his neck and the starched collar which imprisoned it. "Feel like a Christmas goose," he complained to Ralph as the two stood backstage, looking out from behind the curtains. Already sitting in neat rows on the stage were the municipal engineers and harbour and lights employees who'd been associated with Janus over the years. Outside the open windows, the summer's night was alive with the chirrup of crickets. Isabel and her parents sat on one side of the hall, Bill Graysmark holding Lucy on his knee while she rabbited nursery rhymes.
"Just keep your mind on the free beer, son," Ralph whispered to Tom. "Even Jock Johnson can't blather on too long tonight. That get-up must be killing him."
He nodded in the direction of the bald, perspiring man bedecked with ermine-collared robe and mayoral chain who was pacing about, preparing to address the gathering in the rickety town hall.
"I'll join you in a minute," Tom said, "call of nature."
And he headed out to the toilet behind the hall. On the way back, he noticed a woman who seemed to be staring at him. He checked that his flies were buttoned and glanced behind him in case she was observing someone else. Still she looked at him, and as she got closer she said, "You don't remember me, do you?" Tom looked at her again. "Sorry, I think you got the wrong person." "That was a long time ago now," she said, blushing. In that instant something in her expression changed, and he recognized the face of the girl on the boat on his first trip to Point Partagers. She had aged and was thin now, with shadows under her eyes. He wondered if she had some sort of illness. He remembered her in a nightgown, wide-eyed with fear and pinned to the wall by some drunken fool. Memory belonged to a different man, different lifetime. Once or twice over the years, he'd wondered what had become of her, and if the cove had bailed her up. He'd never bothered to mention the incident to anyone, Isabel included, and instinct told him it was too late to tell her about it now.
"I just wanted to say thank you,"
the woman began, but was interrupted by a voice calling from the back door of the hall.
We're about to start. Best be getting in.
Excuse me, said Tom. Got to go, I'm afraid. See you afterwards, perhaps. As soon as he took up his seat on the stage, proceedings got underway. There were speeches and a few anecdotes from some of the older lightkeepers. The unveiling of a model of the original structure.
This model, the mayor announced proudly, was paid for by our local benefactor, Mr. Septimus Potts. I'm delighted that Mr. Potts and his charming daughters, Hannah and Gwen, are attending our little gathering tonight, and I'd ask you to show your thanks in the usual way.
He gestured to an older man sitting beside two women, the first of whom, Tom realized with a sick lurch, was the girl from the boat. He glanced at Isabel, who smiled stiffly as she applauded with the rest of the audience. The mayor continued.
And of course, ladies and gentlemen, we also have with us tonight the current lightkeeper on Janus, Mr. Thomas Sherborne. I'm sure Tom would be delighted to say a few words about life on Janus Rock today.
He turned to Tom and gestured to the podium. Tom froze. No one had mentioned the speech. He was still reeling from the realization that he'd met Hannah Rowenfeld. The audience clapped. The mayor beckoned him again, more forcefully this time.
Up you get, sport!
For just a second he wondered whether everything from the day the boat had washed up might just be one terrible, merciful nightmare. But there in the audience he could see Isabel, Potts and Bluey, oppressively real and inescapable. He got to his feet, heart thudding, and walked to the lectern as if to the gallows.
"'Struth,' he began, sending a ripple of laughter through the audience. "'I wasn't expecting this.'
He wiped his palms on the side of his trousers and gripped the lectern for support.
Life on Janus today.
He stopped, lost in a thought, and repeated.
Life on Janus today.
How could he explain the isolation? How could he make anyone know the world there, as far removed from their experience as another galaxy? The Janus bubble had shattered like glass. Here he was in a crowd, in an ordinary real room, full of people of other lives, in the presence of Hannah Rowenfeld. There was a long silence. A few cleared their throats and others shifted in their seats.
Janus Light was designed by some pretty smart characters, he said. Built by some pretty brave ones.
I just try and do them justice. Keep the light burning. He sought refuge in the technical, in the practical, which he could talk about without having to think. People imagine the light must be huge, but it's not. The actual luminescence comes from a flame of vaporized oil that burns in an incandescent mantle. It gets magnified and directed through a giant set of glass prisms 12 feet high, called a first-order Fresnel lens, which bends the light into a beam so intense you can see it more than 30 miles away. Amazing to think that a little thing can become so strong that you can see it miles off. My job's to keep it clean, keep it turning. It's like being in a different world out there and a different time. Nothing changes except the seasons. There are dozens of lighthouses all around the coast of Australia. Plenty more fellows like me trying to make the ship safe, keeping the light for whoever might need it, even though we'll mostly never see them or know who they are. Can't think what else to say, really, except you can never tell what the tide's going to bring in from one day to the next. Everything that two whole oceans fling at us. You could see the mayor checking his pocket watch. Well, I reckon that's kept you away from the spread for long enough. This is thirsty weather. Thanks, he concluded, turning abruptly to sit down to moderate applause from the bemused audience.
You all right, mate? Ralph asked in a whisper. You look a bit green around the gills.
Not too keen on surprises, was all Tom said. Mrs. Captain Hasluck loved a party. Her penchant was rarely indulged in partageurs, so tonight she was beside herself with delight. She relished her duty as Hardmaster's wife to encourage the guests to mix, especially seeing as there were visitors from Perth. She glided here and there, introducing people, reminding them of their names and suggesting things they had in common. She kept an eye on Reverend Norkel's sherry intake, engaged the superintendent's wife in small talk about the difficulty of laundering the gold braid on uniforms. She even managed to persuade old Neville Witness to tell the story of the day he saved the crew of a schooner whose cargo of rum had caught fire out near Janus in 1899.
"Of course, that was before Federation," he said, "long before the Commonwealth got its hands on the lights in 1915. A lot more red tape since then."
The state governor's wife nodded dutifully and wondered if he knew he had dandruff. Mrs. Captain looked about for her next task and saw her opportunity.
"Isabel, dear,"
she said, laying a hand on her elbow,
"what an interesting speech Tom gave."
She cooed to Lucy, who was perched on Isabel's hip.
"You're up very late this evening, young lady. I hope you're being a good girl for Mummy."
Isabel smiled. "Good as gold." In a crochet hook manoeuvre, Mrs. Hasluck reached out to gather in the arm of a woman who was just passing.
"Gwen,"
she said,
"you know Isabel Sherborne, don't you?"
Gwen Potts hesitated a moment. She and her sister were several years older than Isabel, and having been to boarding school in Perth, neither of them knew her well. Mrs. Captain registered the hesitation.
"Graysmark, you'd know her as Isabel Graysmark," she said.
"Well, I know who you are, of course," she said with a polite smile. "Your father's the headmaster." "Yes," replied Isabel, nausea creeping into her belly. She looked around as though trying to escape with her eyes. Mrs. Captain was beginning to regret the introduction. The Potts girls had never really mixed much with the locals. And then after all that business with the German, well, the sister. Oh dear. She was considering how to rescue the situation when Gwen gestured to Hannah, standing a few feet away.
"Hannah, did you realise Mr. Sherborne, who gave that speech just now, is married to Isabel Graysmark? You know, the headmaster's daughter."
"No, I didn't know," said Hannah, whose thoughts seemed to be elsewhere as she approached. Isabel froze, unable to speak, as a gaunt face slowly turned towards her. She clutched Lucy tighter and tried to utter a greeting, but no words came.
"What's your little one's name?" asked Gwen with a smile.
"Lucy." It was only by supreme effort that Isabel managed not to run from the room.
"Lovely name," said Gwen.
"Lucy," said Hannah, as if pronouncing a word from a foreign language. She was staring at the child and reached out to touch her arm. Isabel flinched with terror at the look in Hannah's eyes as she surveyed the little girl. Lucy seemed hypnotized by the woman's touch. She studied the dark eyes and neither smiled nor frowned, as though concentrating on a puzzle.
"Mama," she said,
and both women blinked. She turned to Isabel.
"Mama," she said again,
"I'm sleepy,"
and rubbed her eyes. For the briefest of moments, Isabel pictured herself handing Hannah the child. She was the mother. She had the right. But she was hallucinating. No, she'd thought about it so many times. There was no going back on her decision. Whatever God meant by this, Isabel had to stay with the plan, go along with his will. She cast about in her mind for something to say.
"Oh, look," said Mrs. Hasluck, seeing Tom approach. "Here's the man at the moment,"
and pulled him in as she moved off to another little group. Tom had been anxious to catch Isabel and slip away as people converged on the trestle tables of sausage rolls and sandwiches. As he realized who Isabel was talking to, his neck tingled, his pulse raced harder.
"Tom, this is Hannah and Gwen Potts," said Isabel, attempting a smile.
Tom stared as his wife, with Lucy on her hip, put her hand on his arm.
"Hello,"
said Gwen. "Pleased to meet you again properly," said Hannah, finally tearing her eyes from the child. Tom could find no words.
"Properly?" queried Gwen.
"We actually met years ago, but I never knew his name." Now Isabel was looking anxiously from one to the other.
"Your husband was very gallant and rescued me from a fellow who was bothering me on a boat from Sydney."
She answered Gwen's silent question.
"Oh, I'll tell you about it later. It's a long time ago now."
To Tom, she said, "I had no idea you were on Janus." There was a heavy silence as they stood inches from each other.
"Dada,"
said Lucy finally and held out her arms to him. Isabel resisted, but the child put her arms around his neck, and Tom let her climb onto him and rest her head against his chest, listening to the drumbeat of his heart.
Tom was about to take the chance to move away when Hannah touched his elbow. "I liked what you said, by the way, about the light being there for whoever needed it." She took up a moment to work up her next words. "Could I ask you something, Mr. Sherborne?" The request filled him with dread, but he said, "Oh, what's that?" "It may seem a strange question, but do ships ever rescue people far out to sea? Have you ever heard of boats being picked up, survivors, taken to the other side of the world, perhaps? I was just wondering whether you'd ever come across stories." Tom cleared his throat. "When it comes to the ocean, anything's possible, I suppose. Anything at all."
"I see. Thank you."
Hannah took a deep breath and looked again at Lucy. "I took your advice," she added. "About that fellow on the boat back then, like you said, he had enough problems." She turned to her sister. "Gwen, I'm ready for home. I'm not much of a one for this kind of ado. Will you say goodbye to Dad for me? I don't want to interrupt him." Then to Tom and Isabel. "Excuse me." She was about to leave when Lucy gave a sleepy "ta-ta" and a wave. Hannah tried to smile. "Ta-ta," she replied. Through tears, she said, "You have a very lovely daughter. Excuse me," and hurried to the door.
"So sorry about that," Gwen said. "Hannah had a terrible tragedy a few years ago. Family lost at sea. Her husband and her daughter would have been about your girl's age by now. She's always asking that sort of thing, seeing little ones sets her off."
"Dreadful," Isabel managed to mutter.
"I better go and see she's all right."
As Gwen left, Isabel's mother joined them.
"Aren't you proud of your daddy, Lucy? Isn't he a clever fellow, giving speeches and what have you?" She turned to Isabel. "Shall I take her home? You and Tom can enjoy the party. Must be years since you've been to a dance."
Isabel looked to Tom for a response. "I'll promise Ralph and Bluey I'd have a beer with them. Not my cup of tea, all this." Without another glance at his wife, he strode out into the darkness. Later that night, when Isabel looked into the mirror, she washed her face. For an instant, it was Hannah's features she glimpsed in the glass, etched with distress. She splashed more water on her skin to wash away the unbearable image, along with the sweat of the encounter. But she couldn't make the picture go away, nor could she tame the other, almost imperceptible wire of fear that came from learning that Tom had met her. She couldn't say why it had made things worse, but somehow it felt as if solid ground had been moved imperceptibly beneath her feet. The encounter had been shocking. To see close up the darkness in Hannah Roenfelt's eyes. To smell the faded sweetness of powder on her. To feel, almost physically, the hopelessness that hung about her. But at the very same time, she had tasted the possibility of losing Lucy. The muscles in her arms stiffened now as if to hold on to the child.
"Oh, God," she prayed. "God, bring peace to Hannah Roenfelt. And let me keep Lucy safe."
Tom had still not come home. She went into Lucy's room to check on her. She took a picture book gently from her hand as she slept and laid it on the dressing table.
"Night-night, my angel," she whispered and kissed her.
As she stroked her hair, she found herself comparing the shape of Lucy's face with a vision of Hannah in the mirror, looking for something in the curve of the chin or the arch of an eyebrow. Chapter 22.
"Mama, can we have a cat?"
Lucy asked the next morning as she followed Isabel into the Graysmarks' kitchen. The child had been fascinated by the exotic marmalade creature called Tabitha Tabby, that patrolled the house. She had seen cats in storybooks, but this was the only one she'd ever touched. "Oh, I don't think a cat would be very happy on Janus, sweetie pie. He wouldn't have any friends to play with." Isabel's voice had a distracted air.
"Dada, can we please have a cat?"
asked the child without missing a beat, oblivious to the tension in the air. Tom had got home after Isabel was asleep and risen before anyone else. He was sitting at the table flipping through a week-old copy of the West Australian.
"Lulu, why don't you take Tabitha out into the garden for an adventure?"
Go hunting for mice, he said. She hauled the compliant animal up by its middle and stumbled to the door. Tom turned to Isabel. How much longer, Is? How much bloody longer? What? How can we do it? How can we carry on with this every day? You knew the poor woman had gone out of her mind because of us, and now you've seen her with your own eyes. Tom, there's nothing we can do. I know it, and so do you. But Hannah's face came back to her, her voice. As Tom set his jaw, she searched for some way of placating him. Perhaps, she ventured, perhaps when Lucy's older, perhaps when we can tell Hannah then, when it won't be so devastating. But that's years away, Tom, years. Astounded by both the concession and by its inadequacy, he pressed on. Isabel, what's it going to take? It can't wait years. Imagine her life. You even knew her. Fear awoke in Isabel in earnest. And it turns out you did too, Tom Sherborne, but you kept that pretty quiet, didn't you? Tom was taken aback by the counterattack. I don't know her. I met her once. When? On the boat from Sydney. That's what's brought this on, though, isn't it? Why didn't you ever tell me about her? What did she mean that you're very gallant? What are you hiding? What am I hiding? That's rich. I know nothing about your life. What else have you kept secret, Tom? How many other shipboard romances? Tom stood up. Stop it. You stop it right there, Isabel. You're carrying on like a two-bob watch over Hannah Rowenfelt to change the subject because you know I'm right. Makes no odds whether I'd seen her before or not. He tried to appeal to reason. Is, you saw what she's become. That's our doing. He turned away from her. I saw things. I saw things in the war, Is. Things that I've never told you and never will. Christ, I did things. His fists were closed tight and his jaw stiff. I swore I'd never make anyone suffer after that, not if I could help it. Why do you think I went on the lights anyway? I reckoned I could maybe do a bit of good. Maybe save some poor bastard from being wrecked. Now look what I've gotten into. I wouldn't want a dog to have to go through what Hannah Rowenfelt's been through. He searched for words. Christ, I learned in France that you're bloody lucky if you've got tucker for tea and teeth to chew it with. He balked at the images that flooded his mind. So when I met you, and you even looked twice at me, I thought I was bloody well in heaven. He stopped for a moment. What are we, Izzy? What do we think we're playing at, for crying out loud? I swore I'd stay with you through thick and thin, Isabel, thick and thin. Well, all I can say is things have got pretty bloody thin, he said, and strode away down the hall. The child stood in the back doorway, watching the end of the argument, spellbound. She had never heard so many words come from Tom's mouth, never so loud, never seen him cry. She's gone! Isabel's words greeted Tom as he returned to the Graysmarks that afternoon in the company of Bluey. Lucy, I left her outside playing with a cat while I went to pack. I thought Mum was watching her and she thought I was watching her. Calm down. Calm down, Iz, he said and put a hand on each arm. Take it quietly. When did you last see her? An hour ago. Two at the most. When did you realise she'd gone? Just now. Dad's gone to look for her up in the bush at the back. Patagers frilled in and out of native bushlands at its fringes. Beyond the Graysmark's neat lawned garden lay acres of scrub that led into forest. Tom, thank goodness you're back. Violet came rushing into the veranda. I'm so sorry, it's all my fault. I should have checked on her. Bill's gone to search up along the old logging track. Are there any other places she's likely to have gone? Tom's methodical, practical reflex came to the fore. Anywhere you and Bill told her stories about. She could be anywhere, said Violet, shaking her head. Tom, there are snakes, redbacks, God help us, Isabel implored. Bluey spoke up. I spent all day in that bush when I was a kid, Mrs. S. She'll be all right. We'll find her no trouble. Come on, Tom. Is, Bluey and I'll head into the bush, see if we can find any tracks. You have another look around the garden out front. Violet, double-check the house. All the cupboards and under the beds. Anywhere she could have followed the cat. If we don't find her next hour, we'll send for the police. Get the black trackers out. Isabel flashed him a look at the mention of police. It won't come to that, said Bluey. She'll be right as rain, Mrs. S. You wait and see. It was only when they're out of earshot of the women that Bluey said to Tom, Let's hope she's making a racket as she goes.
Snakes sleep during the day. They'll get out of your way if they hear you coming, but if they're surprised. She ever wandered off before?
She's never had any bloody where to wander to, Tom said sharply, then.
Sorry, Blue, didn't mean to. It's just that she really hasn't got much of a feel for distance. On Janus, everywhere's close to home. They walked on, calling the child's name as they went, and waiting in vain for a reply. They were following the remnants of a path, now mostly overgrown at adult height, where the branches reached over the empty space below. But at her height, Lucy would have met no resistance. About 15 minutes in, the path opened out into a clearing and then forked in opposite directions.
Loads of these trails, said Bluey. They'd clear a route back in the old days when they went scouting for good timber country. There are still soaks here and there, so you got to watch out.
They're usually covered over, he said, referring to the wells dug out to get at groundwater. The child from the lighthouse has little fear. She knows not to go near cliff edges. She understands that spiders can bite and should be avoided. She's clear that she mustn't try to swim unless Mama or Dada is beside her. In the water, she can tell the difference between the fin of a friendly dolphin, which goes up and down, and of a shark which stays steady as it cuts the surface. In pas de jeux, if she pulls the cat's tail, it might scratch her. These are the boundaries of danger. So, as she follows Tabitha Tabby beyond the borders of the garden, she has no concept of getting lost. After a while, she can no longer see the cat, but by then it is too late. She's too far away to simply retrace her steps, and the more she tries, the further she wanders. Eventually, she comes to a clearing where she sits down by a log. She takes in her surroundings. There are soldier ants, which she knows to avoid, and she makes sure she's a good distance from the trail they're making. She's not concerned. Mama and Dada will find her. As she sits there drawing patterns in the sandy soil with a twig, she notices a strange creature, longer than her finger, approach from under the log. It's like nothing she's ever seen before, a long body and legs like an insect or a spider, but two fat arms like one of the crabs Dada catches sometimes in Janus. Fascinated, she touches it with the twig, and its tail rapidly curls up in a beautiful arch, pointing to its head. In that moment, a second creature appears a few inches away. She is mesmerized by the way the insects follow her twig, trying to grab it with their crab claws. Third one emerges from under the log. The seconds pass slowly. As they reach the clearing, Tom gives a start. He sees a small, shod foot protruding from behind a log.
Lucy!
He races to the log where the little girl sits playing with a stick. He freezes as he recognizes the shape clinging to the end of the twig as a scorpion.
Jesus, Lucy!
He grabs the little girl under her arms and lifts her high in the air as he dashes the scorpion to the ground and crushes it under his foot.
Lucy, what the hell are you doing?
He cries.
Dada, but you killed it!
Lucy, that's dangerous! Did it bite you?
No, it likes me, and look,
she says, opening the wide pocket at the front of her smock, proudly displaying another scorpion.
I got one for you.
Don't move, he says, feigning calm and returning it to the ground. He lowers the twig into the pocket until the scorpion locks onto it and then slowly raises it and flings it into the dirt, stamping on it. He inspected her arms and legs for signs of bites or stings.
You sure it didn't sting you? Does it hurt anywhere?
She shook her head.
I did an adventure.
You certainly did an adventure, all right.
Have a close look, said Bluey.
You can't always see the puncture marks. She doesn't look drowsy, that's a good sign. To tell you the truth, I was more worried she was at the bottom of one of those soaks.
Ever the optimist, muttered Tom.
Lucy, darling, we don't have scorpions on Janus. They're dangerous. You mustn't ever touch them. He hugged her.
Where on earth have you been? I did play with Tabitha, you said to.
Tom felt a stab as he recalled his instruction earlier that morning to go outside with the cat. Come on, sweetie, we've got to get you back to Mama. His mouth seemed newly aware of the significance of the word as the previous night's events came back to him. Isabel rushed from the veranda to meet them at the edge of the garden. She grabbed Lucy and sobbed with relief.
Thank God, said Bill, standing beside Violet. He put his arms around her. Thank the blessed Lord. And thanks to you too, Bluey, he said. You've saved our lives.
All thoughts of Hannah Rowenfelt were swept from Isabel's mind that afternoon, and Tom knew he couldn't raise the subject again.
but he was haunted by her face. The figure who had existed in the abstract was now a living woman, suffering every minute because of what he had done. Every aspect of her, the gaunt cheeks, the harrowed eyes, the chewed fingernails, were vivid in his conscience. Hardest to bear was the respect she had shown him, the trust. Time and again Tom wondered at the hidden recesses of Isabel's mind. The spaces where she managed to bury the turmoil his own mind couldn't escape. When Ralph and Bluey cast off from Janus the following day, having delivered the family back to the light, the younger man said, "Cripes, things seem a bit frosty between them, don't you reckon? Piece of free advice, Blue. Never try and work out what's going on in someone else's marriage." "Yeah, I know, but you think they'd be relieved that nothing happened to Lucy yesterday. Isabel was acting like it was Tom's fault she wandered off. Keep out of it, boy. Time you brewed us up some tea."
Chapter 23. It was one of the mysteries of the Great Southern District, the riddle of what happened to baby Grace Rowenfeld and her father. Some people said it just proved you still couldn't trust a Hun. He was a spy and had finally been called back to Germany after the war. It made no difference that he was Austrian. Others familiar with the oceans didn't bat an eyelid at his disappearance. "Well, what was he thinking, setting off into these waters? Must have had kangaroos in his top paddock. Wouldn't have lasted 5 minutes. There was a general sense that somehow it was God expressing disapproval for Hannah's choice of spouse. Forgiveness is all very well, but look at the sorts of things his lot had done. Old Man Potts' reward took on mythic status. Over the years it lured people from the goldfields, from up north, from Adelaide even, who saw a chance to make their fortune by coming up with a piece of splintered driftwood and a theory. In the early months, Hannah listened keenly to every tale that was spun of a sighting, every memory of a baby's cry heard from the shore on the fateful night. With time, even her eager heart could not fail to see the holes in the stories. When she would suggest that a baby's dress which had been discovered on the shore did not match the one Grace had been wearing, the reward prospector would urge her, "Think! You're overcome with grief. How could you be expected to remember what the poor child was dressed in?" Or, "You know, you'd sleep more easily if you just accepted the evidence, Mrs. Rowenfeld." Then they would make some sour remark as they were ushered from the parlour by Gwen, who thanked them for their trouble and gave them a few shillings for the journey home. That January, the stephanotis was in bloom again, the same voluptuous scent heavy in the air. But it was an even more gaunt Hannah Rowenfeld who continued her ritual journey, though less often now, to the police station, the beach, the church. "Completely off her rocker," Constable Garstone muttered as she wandered out. Even Reverend Norkles urged her to spend less time in the stony darkness of the church and to look for Christ in the life around her. 2 nights after the lighthouse celebrations, as Hannah lay awake, she heard the groan of hinges on the letterbox. She looked at the clock whose eerie numerals signalled 3 a.m. A possum, perhaps. She crept out of bed and peered from the corner of the curtain, but saw nothing. The moon had hardly risen, no light anywhere save for the faint glow of the stars which dusted the sky. Again she heard the iron clang of the box, this time caught by the breeze. She lit a storm lantern and ventured through the front door, careful not to wake her sister, only vaguely wary of disturbing any snakes which might be taking advantage of the inky blackness to hunt for mice or for frogs. Her pale feet made no sound on the path. The door to the letterbox swung gently back and forward, giving glimpses of a shape inside. As she held the lantern closer, the outline of a small oblong emerged, a parcel. She pulled it out. Not much bigger than a hand, it was wrapped in brown paper. She looked about for any hint of how it had got there, but the darkness curled around her lamp like a closing fist. She hurried back to her bedroom, fetching her sewing scissors to cut the string. The package was addressed to her in the same neat hand as before. She opened it. As she pulled out layer upon layer of newspaper, something made a noise with each movement. As the last of the packing was removed, there, returning the soft glimmer of the lantern, was the silver rattle her father had commissioned in Perth for his granddaughter. There was no mistaking the embossed cherubs on the handle. Beneath the rattle was a note. "She is safe. She is loved and cared for. Please pray for me. Nothing more. No date, no initial, no sign. Gwen!